Hey, it's the JRR Are You Tolkien to Me podcast. I'm here for the season finale, episode number 8, Alloyed. And with me, as always, is Jude Fox. Jude, how are you doing tonight?
I have been ringsmithing with the Gwythai Myrdain of Eregion, getting ready for this monumental episode.
Awesome. Gwythai Myrdain. Anyway, so we're going to go through a scene by scene of the whole entire crazy episode that we had here. And then afterwards, we're going to talk about some, some Halbrand, some Galadriel, some Farazan, Elendil, Miriel, Gandalf, the whole thing. Rowan, I just wanted to say that, really crazy, Rowan is on his honeymoon, Jude. Well, his wedding honeymoon.
That guy.
And guess what? He is actually back with O'Leary. She cleaned up her place. She got her shit together. She came back and she realized that he still hasn't broken it to Esther, who he was practically living with. And so anyway, there's a lot going on there.
What do you think the chances are we can get both of them on the show at some point?
Maybe. O'Leary is a. She is a very well-read person, so maybe she's delved into the Tolkien world. I don't know. Anyway, so let's go through the scene by scene. And we're in the Greenwood, Erin Galen. The Greenwood the Great. Meteor Man is off on his own. Like a drifter, he was born to walk alone for about 10 minutes. He's got a makeshift shelter. It has just rained. He is getting up and exploring the woods a little bit. He unwraps the apple that Nori gave him. And he hears her voice telling him that he is good and not a peril. He has that memory of when she told him that.
Yeah, he is definitely not a lot of clothing. You know, apparel.
No, he's got that shroud.
It's not much apparel at all.
No. He's not apparel. Ah, yes, Sensei. It's the Sensei of bad jokes there. But wait for it. We're in Misdirect City, Jude. Why are we in Misdirect City? Because now all of a sudden we got a skittle scattering creepy Nori going on. And that's the creepiest Nori with the evil stare that I've ever seen. And she's like all contorted and she slowly falls to the ground and comes up as the Dweller.
Yep.
And I liked the shift. I love the shifts to the Dweller. And her stare is crazy. She knows how to stare, that Dweller.
Yeah, well, I for one, have taken to calling the cultists there simply the People's Temple of Sauron.
The PTS.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what. In a second, all three of them are there. And you know what? Say it ain't so.
Oh, it's so.
Say it ain't so. They hail Meteor Man as Sauron. And then we get the title credits. Bum, bum, bum.
And what did you feel about the apple imagery and the biblical imagery that they used tempting Meteor Man to evil?
Well,
notice he never bites the apple. I think that's very specific.
And it's also an inverse. If he was truly satanic, he would be giving the apple.
True.
And anyway, they just want you to say it ain't so.
It ain't so.
But we cut to Galadriel. She is galloping to Eregion with Halbrand in tow. He is draped over the back of his horse. It seems like he is unconscious.
And we know that Galadriel does love her horses.
Yes. But this ride is less gleeful.
A little bit.
Then we see Celebrimbor. He's talking to Mr. Elrond, and they're wondering how to do more with less. I mean, the sun once could fit into his hand. That comes straight from Tolkien lore. It was taken from one of the trees of Valinor. Anyway, Elrond thinks he does not have hope for the elves staying in Middle-earth. He's pretty hopeless about that.
Ah, hope.
At this point. But Galadriel gets there and with Halbrand, and they arrive, and then immediately they take him to the healers. And Galadriel then later is talking to Elrond, who apologizes for not trusting her. And she knew that she had to jump off the ship, and she knows that she was saying she has to do the next right thing. Just keep swimming. Just do what her heart tells her. Her job wasn't done. Just keep swimming.
Keep on swimming. Keep on swimming.
Yeah. And so here we go. Now, now we're getting into the Tale of Two Saurons portion of the episode, as I like to call it. Celebrimbor is all alone. And guess who comes in?
Could it be Halbrand?
It is Halbrand.
No.
It's Halbrand, and he's approaching, and he looks way better. Like, he is mostly healed. And he finds out it's Celebrimbor he's talking to there in the room, and he just plays him like a fiddle, I think.
Yeah.
He plays on his vanity. He's like, talks about how the master he apprenticed under said great shit about Celebrimbor. He loved his stuff.
Boy, did he.
He really dug his stuff, man. Anyway, so who was his master that he served under? Was it Morgoth? Was it Aule? The smith? Who he's referring to? He's always referring to somebody. He just doesn't tell you who.
No.
He's always telling you the truth.
Yeah.
Halbrand, he immediately seems to dominate the conversation, and he wants to know about the Mithril.
Yeah, so although most of what he's doing is asking questions, allowing Celebrimbor to come up, quote-unquote, come up with the answers himself.
Mm-hmm. So he asks him about the Forge, he asks him about, what is this place? What about the Mithril? And Celebrimbor just tells this dude everything. and Halbrand starts counseling. He starts consulting him and explaining about the alloy process. And this turns out to be the greatest suggestion that Celebrimbor's ever heard, it looks like.
It is.
And and here comes the bomb.
What does Halbrand say of his suggestions? What is it?
Well, think of it as a gift.
A gift?
No. Oh, you blue-eyed, silver-tongued devil.
I've heard of a giver of gifts before. Who could that be?
So, ladies and gentlemen, we got ourselves a true Sauron off.
Mm-hmm.
Will the real Sauron please stand up? And Halbrand, he seems like such a helpful, nice dude, you know? But we'll get into that later. So anyway, we're in Numenor, and Farazan is, he's talking about forging Tar Palantir's tomb. And he says this about that, granting him the immortality in stone that no man, not even a king, could obtain in life. So he's heavily thinking about the mortality of man.
Yes, there. And he's giving off real usurper vibes, I felt.
Right. Well, you know, we know how that's going to go because we know the books. But Aeorian is, she's one of the possible draftsmen that if she wins the contest, she's basically on like Farazan's version of The Apprentice. And one lucky contestant who's skillful enough is going to get to design the tomb of the king. And so you get the gig, you get to spend an hour alone with the dying king, capturing his visage, and then you're competing against other draftsmen.
That sounds like fun.
You know, hey. And so we cut to Aeorian's time with him. And she's like, I don't know, she's wiping some schmutz off of his face.
Let me wipe you.
And he grabs her arm, yeah, and he says, I know what you've been doing in the dark of night when you thought all eyes were asleep.
And what does that mean? Ooh. I mean, come on, come on.
Muriel, don't touch it, you'll go blind.
She had to be getting some real paranoid vibes from that.
Muriel, stop touching your Palantir.
Is that what they call it now?
Oh, good Lord. That's what they said. They wrote that down in a script, and they read it, and that's the way they approached it.
Oh, boy.
So, I thought it was okay. And, but he goes on, and he is not, she's like, oh, I'll go get your chambermaid. You must be talking about her, that bitch. She crazy. But, so no, he goes on, and it's clear he's talking about Muriel, his daughter, and...
Which makes it even creepier.
Yeah, well, you know.
I'm just
he's
saying.
He's just talking about the Palantir.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So he needs Muriel to know that she must restore the old ways back to Numenor, or that island is going to fall. And, he's used the Palantir so much that he can't tell past from present from future. He's useless at this point.
He is burnt out.
He's burnt. And, he needs her to do it.
But she's not there.
She's not there, but Eärion is there. And so she approaches the Palantir, and we get the buildup of the ominous music as she's approaching, and she pulls off the sheet.
So do you feel they're setting her up to be a seer?
Well,
it certainly seems that way, right?
She's going to put her hands on the Palantir and see the future that everyone sees.
This isn't a metaphor anymore, is it?
Mm-mm. Nope.
I mean, I imagine she's already put her hands on her own Palantir, but...
It's just, look, knowledge is a terrible thing. J.R.R. Tolkien, and also, ladies, don't touch your things. So now we cut to, that's Tolkien saying that, not me, ladies.
Yeah, I recall him saying that.
All right, so now we cut to Gil-galad and Elrond, and Celebrimbor, and Galadriel, and Gil-galad, he's got that chunk of mithril, and he's wondering how one little piece of mithril is going to do the trick in this here situation of the dying elves. And Celebrimbor wants to make a crown. And he's like one round, like an object that's circular so that the light arcs, causing basically what I look at as a power feedback loop.
Right. And he's talking about the light from the gems, which we had seen previously, the three small gems representing, what is it, fire, water, and air, I believe.
So, yeah. And so he gives this theory to Gil-galad, who thinks that these whisperings are perilous. And he tells them that the elves, they gotta go. They're not gonna be able to stay in Middle-earth, because since Mount Doom erupted, the leaves are just falling off the tree.
It's been bleeding leaves.
Bleeding leaves, like crazy. And so this actually, you know, sets Celebrimbor off a bit, Jude. He kind of gets on the defensive, and in refutation, he starts quoting
someone,
a new friend of his.
Yeah.
And the friend is, and he's using the same quotes, curiously enough, that Adar used. He's forging a power that is not of the flesh, but over flesh. And it's using the power of the unseen world. And this does not work on Gil-galad, by the way. He's like, disband the project, go to Lindon now. It's over. We don't have the time.
But at least he's happy to see Galadriel back, right?
Yeah, no, he just shades her ass right up. You shouldn't even be standing here. Anyway. So now Galadriel is alone with Celebrimbor, and she hears what he's saying. And she's like, what about the words that you use, the exact phrases? But he seems a bit disoriented, confused, like dismissive also.
No, I believe those were my words.
Yeah, I said that stuff. absent-minded. Was Halbrand there when you said it? I don't know. Doesn't matter. Whatever, it's over now. So he's like, he seems a little bit bewitched, I think.
Good way of putting it.
Bewitched, bothered, and bewildered is Celebrimbor. So Elrond wants 3 months. He's talking to Gil-galad. He's like, you give me 3 months, and you owe me that. And Gil-galad's like, I owe you nothing. Well, then just do it because it's me, your buddy. It's your boy, Elrond, I'm asking.
I knew.
No, but, you know, remember that wisdom that you passed on to me? Hope is never mere, not even when it is meager.
And Gil-galad's like, oh, fine.
Yeah, I said that.
I did say that.
Damn it.
Hating myself right now.
So anyway, they continue forging in Eregion. We got the montage. We get the Gwyth Aemerdain. But they look like a bunch of college interns, Jude.
College, if that.
I don't know. It's just like you think about
they're
this.
They're kids. They look like kids.
They worked on those rings for 200 years in the lore. And now you're watching these interns.
They're going for like 200
minutes. I think
minutes
I saw it, one of them getting coffee. So Halbrand is all up in that shit. He is Celebrimbor's right-hand man. He is his partner.
No, he's whispering into his ear
but
sweet nothings.
But also seriously trying to figure shit out.
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting in the Halbrand redemption story, which we'll talk about. So, you know, Galadriel is very sus. She's not sus. She is suspicious. She's
putting things together.
Yeah, she's getting an archivist to look further into Halbrand's lineage, his sigil. And we get a little nod. There's a little group walks by with Elrond, and we overhear Elrond talking to Celebrimbor saying, we got to do in 3 weeks what it should take 3 centuries to do. And I thought that was funny, since that's the actual amount of time that the Gwyth Aemerdain work on those goddamn rings, right? So anyway, Halbrand and Galadriel are now, he comes out and they're talking alone. And now shit's really about to go down because, you know, he's just acting like a humble servant. It's like the honor to be working with the smiths of Eregion. And he thanks her for saving his life. And basically he's about to sing Wind Beneath My Wings, I believe, to Galadriel. She is
feels
the
that
wind,
way.
He does. And he won't ever let anyone forget what Galadriel's done for him.
That's right.
Which is a bit strange to say. It's kind of a weird thing. I'm not going to let anyone ever forget what you did for me.
That you saved my life.
That's right. No one's ever. And they're making heavy eye contact. And I have to say, like, there is definitely
some tension. Some sexual tension.
There is like a level that you might say that Sauron. Well, did I say Sauron?
Uh-oh.
Halbrand. And Galadriel have for each other.
Little Sam and Diane action.
A little ditty about Jack and Diane.
Ooh.
I don't know. Anyway, the cult, not the band, but those three crazy ladies, they're with Eminem, Meteor Man.
You mean the People's Temple of Sauron?
Correct. And they're talking up his Sauron powers. They're like really fluffing him up here. They're telling him he's got to go to Rune. They're giving him information where his stars can be seen, the ones he's looking for. And he'll be known there for who he truly is, Sauron.
Yes.
Then they really start talking up his Sauron powers. And he starts doing some Tempest kind of stuff with the wind and the power, and it's raising, and he's really getting into it and letting the Sauron stuff go to his head.
Yeah, and is there any question as an audience member at this point, that that Meteor Man is actually Sauron. I mean, did you feel, Rob, that there was any question at this point?
No, I mean, because of all the Halbrand stuff.
I mean, even without that, I felt that this was fine for the show characters, but as an audience member, I said, he is clearly good, as he will say.
Yeah. I mean, it was all just waiting for how it was going to turn. And, well, anyway, the Dweller, she has to sedate him by blowing some magic at him. She blows a little Dweller dust at him.
And, so you're saying she blows him. That's nice.
She blows him unconscious.
Yeah.
And I mean that in the cleanest way. Okay. Children, if you're listening. Jude is a bad man, and he means dirty things. So don't listen.
I'm not the one who said it.
So the cult, they hear something in the woods. It's the Harfoots, Sadik, Nori, Poppy, and Marigold. So Nori, she manages to get to Meteor Man. And I got to say, he does get a little Sauron-y in the eyes when he looks at her.
Yes, and that is because that's not him.
Because he ain't. But anyway, so Sadik grabs him. But the Nomad, one of the cult members of the Republic of
Sauron Temple.
Yeah. The Nomad, she throws a blade into his side.
F the Nomad. I am so pissed at that bitch.
Well, she's a good shot with that blade.
I do not like her anymore.
So they're about to kill Nori, but Eminem, Meteor Man, he's going to raise up his power, and there's a fierce wizard sorcerer battle with the Dweller.
Yeah.
Whose staff is helping her to dominate him.
She's just throwing fire left and right. She looks like Charlie McGee from Firestarter.
Yeah, I love her blonde hair. This is shot and the way that she moves. She's awesome.
It's awesome. It's awesome. But, you know, her blonde hair does not make her Drew Barrymore, let me tell you.
I like her better. But thanks to Poppy, Nori, they distract the Dweller and they get the staff. Nori swipes it. So that's going to come in handy. And the Dweller starts burning the forest down. Now she's had enough.
Yep.
She's just using her magic to spread the fires throughout. Meteor Man gets up, and Nori gives him the staff. And now, at this point, I guess they've lifted the veil over Meteor Man's conscious mind.
Yeah.
And he can now speak coherently, and Nori convinces him that they're wrong about his identity, that he can choose to be good. It's a choice. And just
Which
like
is an
that.
Interesting yeah. theme for the entire episode, I think. You know, whether you are created a certain way or whether you can choose your path. But that'll come back into play later on.
Right. Right. Well, and if you can choose it for good, even if you're evil, you could choose for good.
Yep.
So anyway, he's good. He starts putting out the fire. He obviously chills out the woods. He takes the temperature down, and he bids the cult return to the shadow. And he's
the shadows from which you came.
Mm-hmm, and they call him the Istar. He is one of the Istari. And as they return to the shadow, they look just like the Nazgul.
Yeah.
So what are they?
That's
the question.
I think this begs the question, even though they've been banished now within the show, whether they are going to potentially be able to come back. I feel it's pretty likely that we will see more of the People's Temple of Sauron here.
Well,
in the coming seasons. We'll see.
Meteor Man, actually, here's another nod to him being Gandalf, right?
Aloran.
Aloran. But, you know, they're going to call him Gandalf, I think.
Ugh.
He turns them into butterflies, and also the staff as they disappear into nothingness.
Yes, yeah, so
they become butterflies.
Moths. In fact.
Well, you know.
It's
a moth. To me, it might be a butterfly.
Well, we saw him with the moth in the film version of the Two Towers. So yeah. I think that was
moths.
Visual reference to that.
Fine, moths. And so Sadak's gonna die. But it's all right, because the missus, she'll be waiting for him.
Yeah, am I the only one who thought that Aloran was going to heal Sadak at that point?
Like, I don't know.
I'm just waiting. I'm like,
it's his time.
Well, you know, come on, we've seen him heal. Come on, he's going to heal the guy. Like, it's, and then he's like, you know, he just kind of gives him a little look like, all right, see you later, buddy.
Yeah, I think that's what he wanted. He wanted to see his wife again. He's done his shit. And he's just going to sit up awkwardly in an uncomfortable position, in a slight amount of discomfort, rolling his eyes a little bit.
Just
not screaming and sweating and dying in the ground in a ditch, as you would.
No crying.
If you had an actual belly wound.
Yeah. Especially from a magic blade.
Couldn't they go a little bit closer to that, though? Could they give a little bit more of the reality of, like, even if you're at peace, there's got to be that struggle.
They could have. I mean, they didn't, but they definitely could have.
They should have. Let's turn could have into should have and show, come on. If you can show us a body half incinerated with the guy still alive and kicking.
With one leg.
Last episode.
Yeah.
You can show Sadak, you know.
Struggling
a little
bit.
Going through the depths of dying. Anyway, Muriel is talking to Elendil on the ship. Back to Numenor, and Elendil has come full circle back on his faithfulness. He's back, man.
Yeah, yeah.
He is on the righteous path. Elendil does not merely mean one who loves the stars, he tells her. And Muriel's on the same page.
He is an elf friend.
And they come up with the way of the faithful is continuing to pay the price. In the end, it will be worth it. And we make the end worth the price, come what may. They agree to this. So they're really like, I'm going to ship these two, and I'm going to say that Elendil is going to eventually become the king through marrying Muriel, who's going to be forced to separate from him and then marry her cousin Farazan. That's what I think's going to happen, because he's going to become king, and that's what happens. Some of that happens in the text. So we'll see. We'll see how they deal with that.
Come what may on Blue Bayou.
Okay.
Oh, am I the only one? Seriously?
Oh, because of the come what may?
Yes, yes, yes.
Right, but they are going back to Numenor, but they're not going back to Blue Bayou.
They're going back someday.
Yeah, no, it's Roy Orbison. You don't need to sing it. On deck,
the
returning
soldiers.
I'm
not singing it, I'm butchering it.
The returning soldiers are witnessing the black banners draped everywhere. And this
signaling?
Is signaling that the old king has passed.
Yes, it is.
We see Farazan overlooking Tar Palantir's dead body, pensively, and he's got to be thinking about eventually taking rule himself somehow.
How he's going to do that.
And also about mortality.
In and
of itself, right?
I'm feeling he doesn't like the idea. I don't know why. Something's giving me that impression. Doesn't like the idea of mortality. That Farazan.
No. Back in Eregion, there is an explosion in the Forge Tower. Pa-ka-ka-boom! And, Celebrimbor is in action, and he's like, the high-pressure approach. They can't do any more pressure. It's not working. Anyway, Halbrand comes up with the idea that the metals need to be coaxed together instead of forced.
Yeah, he continually says just enough to let Celebrimbor feel that he came up with the ideas, though.
Sure, sure. But it's also, by the way, the coaxing is how Halbrand is working the elves. And at this point, the coaxing is his way of coming to power in Middle-earth. It's not Morgoth's approach, which was more like what the Forgers were just trying to do.
Right, forcing it.
So now, this is... what connects Sauron, his work as someone, a craftsman, with his philosophy to rule. It kind of links the two things together.
Sauron, that's do we nice. Have a Sauron yet?
No, not yet. Come on. We have a Come thing. On,
let's not rush this.
But Galadriel finds that Halbrand isn't who he's pretending to be, or at least she thinks. So Halbrand approaches her by the banks of the river, and he tells her they need to make two objects to hold all that power of that alloy, which me right away I continued to be like, yeah, this guy wants one of these objects, I think.
Yeah, and the concept right there in this scene bothered me a bit of creating two objects when we know that there are three gems which need to go in them, meaning that at this stage that would imply that one of them would be more powerful than the other, as opposed to them being equal in any capacity. Well,
I think it's clear that the two-gemmed one, Halbrand, would eventually somehow play his chess to win that piece.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
If that was the more powerful one, but he's playing it by ear, right? So she's like, tell me who you really are. And she presses him, and she has the scrolls that tell him the last man to bear that crest died over 1,000 years ago.
She accuses him of lying.
Well, and he says, well, I told you I found it on a dead man. And everything that he says along the way, everything that she accuses him of doing, he actually didn't do. He tells her the truth.
Never lied.
He didn't tell the whole truth, though. That's the thing. No. But now we know he's about to come clean, and he lays this one out there. I've been awake since before the first breaking of the first silence, and in that time, I've had many names. Boom! Jude, we got us a Sauron.
I like to think we have a Sauron.
Sauron. Yeah. You know, Sauron, it's too ethnic. It's too ethnic. Yeah. I think I'm going to go with Halron. Because you got the Halbrand and the Sauron, you put them together, yeah. And you got Halron.
Halron, that's terrible.
Come on.
That's terrible.
Audience, what do you think? Halron?
Rob, we've got to talk.
Okay. All right, let's move on. So anyway, she goes to stab him. Boom! But he stops her very effortlessly, because he's a Sauron. And she casts, she's cast into a memory of her talking to her brother Finrod back in Valinor.
Not a genuine memory, though.
It's probably just
an entire illusion.
Yeah. But it's Finrod telling her that Sauron is actually an ally.
He's a pretty good guy.
Yeah, and she calls, but she's entranced by it, but she's going to eventually just call bullshit on that scene. And Finrod Sauron is like, kind of loses his shit. Look at me, he screams, and then the scene cuts, and now she's in a different scene, and she's on the raft in the Sundering Sea with him. Yeah. And they're both on the raft. And here we get a little bit of sympathy for the devil here. And this is the whole, what we were talking about, the dimensionality.
He should have just told her, you know, let me introduce myself.
Right. He is a man of wealth and grace. But anyway, Sauron's story is that Morgoth...
was a dick.
Was it no longer has him in his grasp. And he wants to repent. But the only way that he can really do it is by healing the world that he helped do so much to destroy. And it's a great scene because it really does...
He makes a great argument.
He does make a good argument. Like, there's no way that he can turn to good without proving himself in some way first. At least that's his story. I mean, I'm sure that... Galadriel would say, well, no, get your ass to Valinor and repent in front of the gods.
Well, you know.
He's not about to do that.
Let's not go too far.
No. And anyway, he hasn't lied about anything directly.
Not one thing.
But he's never told the whole truth. And however, he did this in the service of giving himself a chance to prove himself. So he's lying in order to give himself this cushion and do some good for the world, apparently. And yep. then he can plead his case, right? But Galadriel...
I'm kind of buying into it.
And he wants Galadriel to be his queen.
Yeah.
But she can see in the reflection of the water, the reality of who she's standing next to. She sees the Sauron we're used to seeing. She sees your daddy, Sauron.
Well, you know, right there, when they're speaking, and she tells him that he would be a dark lord, and he tells her, he says, no, not dark. And she asks about, you know, herself and what he says. I found this very interesting. He says, I would make you a queen, fair as the sea and the sun, stronger than the foundations of the earth, which is interesting because in the books, when later on in the Third Age, when Galadriel is offered the One Ring by Frodo, her words are, in place of a dark lord, you will set up a queen, and I shall not be dark, but beautiful and terrible as the morning and the night, fair as the sea and the sun and the snow upon the mountain, dreadful as the storm and the lightning, stronger than the foundations of the earth. All shall love me in despair. And so basically what he's telling her now, she basically will use later on when offered power again, which I kind of liked the writing there. You know, it's not a direct quote, but rather it's something that you could interpret as inspiring her words later on.
Right. And it's, she is looking to her North Star of her morality, which is, ultimately power is with Iluvatar, or power is with the gods.
Right.
And he just, that's not his philosophy. That's what creates Tolkien's version of evil. So he argues that the elves need him, because now he starts to become more threatening.
Yeah.
That this isn't working. And he argues that the elves need him to survive. He threatens to tell the elves that Sauron lives because of Galadriel. Now, which is, you can't argue that he does, that he doesn't.
How are they gonna feel?
And
when
then,
they find out,
you and then she's back to sinking in the sea, like she did in episode 2, when he saved her.
Yep.
And eventually, it's going to be Elrond who lifts her out of the water, but we're back in Eregion, in reality, not in a vision. But she doesn't know that for sure, and she holds a dagger to his throat, basically. And then she gives him the identity test, you know. What's your mother's maiden name? What was the name of your first pet?
Last four digits of your social security number.
Yeah. So he passes the identity test. He tells her that about his childhood, which is slightly off lore.
It's a little bit different. A bit weird, but...
He does have a twin brother. He was sort of taken in by two of Feanor's sons.
Should not have been alone, yeah.
But he tells her what he tells her, and she believes it. Apparently it was a shared memory. So anyway, he wants to know where Halbrand is, she asks where Halbrand is.
Yep.
And he says he's gone. And she's like, well, he's gone. Trust me, he's gone forever. And just, you're going to have to trust me on his, just trust me. Don't ask any more questions about this Halbrand dude.
Yeah, and his leaving means that what we're not going to get, at least not directly, we got a little bit of it, but we're not going to get Gil-galad being one of the elves not to trust Sauron in this guise. Which is what we get in the books. We got a little bit of a hint towards that when he said about Celebrimbor getting his idea from the low man and him not really liking that, but we're not getting the direct idea of Gil-galad not trusting Sauron, nor, I believe it was Elrond is the other one in the books right. who and doesn't
they,
trust
But they were
him.
Also in separate cities.
Right. So it's, so that, it's again, a little, it's a bit of a change. Bit it's not not an awful one. I'm not mad at it, but it is a bit of a change tonight. Right.
So, but Galadriel tells them that they have to make three rings.
Oh, because there's three gems? Duh.
Yeah, but that's not the reason.
I know.
It's
I
because
know.
One yes. will corrupt. Two will divide.
But with three,
there is balance. Celebrimbor agrees. And Celebrimbor, he needs Galadriel to sacrifice the gold and silver from her dagger because it is from Valinor. And he needs that purest of gold and silver to go with that Mithril.
Yep.
So anyway, now we're back to what?
Well, before that, Galadriel also, interestingly, she says, "The powers we forge today must be for the elves alone, untouched by other hands." Which is kind of interesting because other hands, once again, as we know, will ultimately touch them as Meteor Man, a.k.a. Alorin, a.k.a. Gandalf, will end up being one of the possessors of the Three Rings, which will be given by Gil-galad to him. So right. I think her specific words are kind of interesting, as we know it won't actually go the way she's thinking already. So there's already a little question as to what she's thinking and just how that's going to work out.
Okay. So now we cut to, we're still going to call him Meteor Man for a second, but anyway, he's talking to Nori.
Lauren.
And she says that he's Istar. They called him Istar, which is one of the Istari, which means wise one or wizard. And we're going to get some more conclusive Gandalf, Alorin proof, or at least very strong suggestion in the next scene. But before that, what we have is we see the Harfoots all together. They're gathering up to continue on to the next leg of their migration, and Malva is trying to do Sadak's job as the leader, and it looks like Poppy's going to need to be the new trail finder, huh?
Yeah, well...
Because she doesn't seem to be very skilled at reading that map, which is upside down.
Malva says about which way they're going and what have you, and after doing all that with the... you know, nobody walks off trail, nobody walks alone. But she says, "Sounded better when Sadak said it. Wish the old goat were still with us." And the other one with her, which I believe her name is Vilma, who is carrying the big book. Like she says, "Oh, he is." And I just wanted her to continue on saying, "You skinned a bit of him and put it in the book, remember?" I think that would be a tradition I could see these Harfoots kind of going with. You know, that big leather book? They add a little bit of their fall into it each time.
Yeah, and you're talking to someone, right, Jude? So, anyway.
Don't worry, I'm not going to skin you. Well, maybe.
So we get, we get a little bit of the Harfoot love and wisdom here. We got the tearful goodbye. Nori... really is going to need to be with Meteor Man, Gandalf, Alorin, Mithrandir, or Blue Wizard, Radagast. We're not concluding anything definitively, but based on the way the show
kind of are.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a second. But I really feel like, as a father, that this speaks a lot to me, sending a kid off.
Yeah.
These are the pearls of wisdom that he had given her. Never squat by a river.
Womp, womp.
You might need to drink downstream, right?
That's disgusting.
A Harfoot without manners will get as far as a square wheel. That was the last one. And always quench your fire. So
they've learned from fire.
Anyway, so there's the cheerful goodbye to Poppy.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I thought that she would go with her, kind of like a Sam and Frodo kind of situation with Poppy.
Yeah, when Poppy ran back up to Noria as she's heading to Alorin, I just figured that, oh, okay, she's coming up. She's going to go with her. But no, she's still going to hang around with the tribe there.
Right. I think they need her because they're not going to get far if somebody can't read a map.
Yeah, she's going to be their trailblazer.
And the singer. She's the singer of the group.
Oh, true.
So,
incidentally, that backpack that Nori is carrying at that point, I mean, that is going to give that poor girl lower back problems, like, pretty quickly. That just did not look like a great idea.
No. Anyway, it wasn't well
designed.
So anyway, so we see he's going to give her the Meteor Man is going to give her the advice that really, really means a lot to the Gandalf theory, which is
Alorin.
Follow your nose. You know, when in doubt, follow your nose. He said it to Meriodac.
Meriadic.
Right? Meriadic.
Yeah.
You say Meriadic, I say Meriadoc. That's a famous song in Middle Earth.
Oh yeah. So I've heard that one.
There's also, what's the last name? It's Brandy.
Brandy Buck, I believe.
Brandy Buck, and her last name is Brandyfoot.
Yeah.
But he almost says the same exact words, basically.
Just a difference in the name.
And it's a beautiful day, and we're seeing the Harfoots off on their next leg of the migration on this beautiful day.
Pun intended. They have little legs, very little legs.
Right.
They're
right.
So small.
Yes. So anyway, so Galadriel is giving her dagger to the college intern of the Gwythi Meridine.
Who probably just came back from getting high.
Yeah. No, you got to sign some papers before you work that forge, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why it blew up before.
You know what they're doing on the lunch break, those kids.
And they're getting it from Halbrand, because he's a Sauron. So anyway, but now we can say it definitively. You know, we got to come clean about something a little while about that. I'm going to just say about Halbrand as Sauron. Anyway, she watches the dagger melt, and then we see the whole forging process. And we see the three rings event. Well, before that, we see the Migthril.
Yes.
When it's dropped in, it looks a little like that Sauron eye when they dropped him. Exactly.
It looks exactly like it. It's very intentional.
Yes.
Like, it looks like his eye, and then, go ahead.
Right. And then we get the three rings are being forged. But in the meantime, Elrond, what?
No, interestingly, like, It's a pretty interesting process that you see with the gold and silver coming through, because the gold and silver are mixed together in the crucible. And then as they come down, they separate as if by, you know, Elven Smith or Gwythi Myrdain magic into their separate ingots. So you get this separation in the process somehow, which is clearly some kind of eldritch magic, providing us with the distinct silver and gold metals, which the rings will canonically be made of at that point.
Cool. Good point. So anyway, in the meantime, Elrond goes back to the river, and he finds the scroll that Galadriel had left there with the lineage of Halbrand's or Sauron's sigil.
And he figures it all out because he's no dummy.
He realizes it. And but when we get back, Celebrimbor is sort of proudly gazing at his rings, at the result of his work.
Yep.
Galadriel's looking at it, and we get the three rings.
For the Elven Kings.
Yep. Vilya, Nenya, and Narya. So we get those three, the blue, the red, and the white. But he's looking, Elrond and Galadriel lock eyes, and he kind of, she sees, I think, that he has that scroll, and she knows that he knows. She knows that he knows that he knows that he's, you know who. So then we fade into the reflection of, it's the reflection of Mount Doom in Halbrand's blue Saurony eye.
Yeah.
It's kind of like another Sauron eye, but in a really, really interesting way. And here we go, Jude. You got your classy Anakin.
And
here it is.
And he simply walks into Mordor. And as we know, no one simply walks into Mordor.
Right, but unless you're Halron.
Saurbrand. But anyway.
Halron.
Saurbrand.
So anyway. Listen, you remember when you said classy Anakin?
Yes, sir.
All right, so...
I will agree that I feel that this is better written than the descent by Anakin. Once again, I do not love the way that character arc is written, and
but at least they gave it three films,
right? And this is also gotten.
But this wasn't a descent; this was a cover up, really.
Well, I think there is some debate to be had right here about just where Sauron, or Saurbrand, is at this point. Is he truly evil? Is he really still attempting to be repentant? Is it Galadriel who pushed him into having no or seeing no other option than to be evil? I think we are going to still have more to discover and to play out in this character arc of his.
I think
in the coming seasons.
I think he is doing a really, really good job of playing somebody who sincerely believes that they deserve redemption. But when she pushes him a little too hard, he kind of shifts gears pretty quickly into a threatening mode. He also doesn't know the difference between healing and ruling.
Well, he doesn't thinks see he's a the distinction.
His ego is clearly going to be out of control if he's controlling it at this point. He's not always going to. You can hear that in his... the way he sees himself and the way he praises Galadriel, that they're clearly going to be two unique beings who are above, any sort of justice. And that's just how, he's going to fall back into being a cruel overlord, no matter what happens. So, but did Galadriel push him back into darkness? Could she have binded him to the light with her goodness if they were a team? I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think she wanted that. I don't think she believed in that. Although,
I think it's an interesting debate to be had about it, though.
I think it's very interesting the way they looked at each other a lot of the time, like they were in love. I think that adds dimension to it. Anyway, go ahead.
But. No. Sorry, I was going to mention, so after Halbrand, Saurbrand, walking into Mordor, we finally close with the song "Where the Shadows Lie," which this in particular version is composed by the series composer, Bear MacCready, and sung by Fiona Apple, which I absolutely loved. I thought it was a great closing for the season. What'd you think, Rob, as a musician?
Okay, here's the thing. I like it musically. I just, when I hear lyrics that were clearly not meant to really be song lyrics, anyway, done in a style like that, I find it a little comical because it doesn't sound like they... It almost seems like there should be a rhyme in there somewhere because it's a song, and there never is. So it always seems to be, like, in my mind, done off the cuff, even though it's very clearly to the melody. But it's cool.
So I think
it's not
we have
my
a,
favorite. Though.
We have a little bit of a different take on it.
It's not my favorite. I like some enough. Of the other some of the music from The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. I thought was really impactful. I accepted. I think it's cool. Anyway, let's talk about just a real quick. The only reason we cited every piece of evidence basically when we saw it for Halbrand being Sauron. The only reason why we would always caveat it with he's not is because
it was too obvious.
It was the one of the first characters to be focused on. It was the first thing that anyone predicted. This show is clearly not really about curveballs, so that's why I would say that if Gandalf, you know, if Meteor Man, the Stranger, is not Olorin or Gandalf or Mithrandir, whatever they're going to decide to call him, it would be odd.
It would be shocking.
That they're not throwing curveballs at all. So
the evidence is perhaps as strong, if not stronger, for Meteor Man to be Olorin than it was for Halbrand to be Sauron, and that's saying a lot.
I mean, at this point, it should. It's almost.
I mean, we have a direct quote.
Unless they start getting a little bit more curveball-y,
which would be cool. I would love to see that. I'm no longer of the mind that it will happen, but I would love to see it. I would love to be proven wrong.
There are still unexplored dimensions of Sauron in this period. And whether, like, how did he end up in that sea?
Yeah, it's still a bit of a mystery. I don't know if it'll be answered, but
like, what what form was he in when Adar stabbed him?
Yeah.
Adar didn't recognize this form.
No.
Why were the cult members so far off base? They didn't know he was around anywhere? He didn't want them to know. He didn't want any to do with his past, maybe. This was his kind of clean slate.
Yeah, I feel this, the way it's presented, I feel, once again, if we think that they're not big on the curveballs, that that what he's saying, I feel maybe very genuine in that he is attempting to have redemption. We know ultimately what the fate will be, but it's an interesting story to explore if that is genuine.
Well, I mean, he knows that this, you know, cult exists, I'm sure. If he wanted to just start ginning up power, he would go to a base. I think he would go to Rune. This is his other plan. This is exactly how he came up with the idea for the rings themselves, which was coaxing things instead of by force.
And I also love the fact that he's being played very much like this Luciferian character, in particular a John Milton version of the character, you know, Paradise Lost, where, you know, he is a complex character. He is someone who does not lie. We don't even know if he's capable of lying. He's capable of deceiving, clearly, but that's not the same thing. The two are not mutually exclusive.
But he...
Which is interesting.
His part of his... The art of his deception was to be able to say, I didn't lie.
Right. And that's
could
a,
lie. He was making a strategic choice.
Well, again, we've seen, again, in the show version, we've seen no evidence that he is a character who would ever lie, necessarily. And, you know, that is always an interesting character to write and to watch. And
well,
I'm
it's kind
curious.
Of a classic villain.
Yeah. I'm curious. Yeah. It's a classic Luciferian character that, you know, I never lied. I deceived you, but I never lied. You know, I did it without lying. And that's always an interesting way to go about this.
No,
and I hope they continue.
That's part of the oath when you're being sworn into a trial is to tell the whole truth. That's the whole thing. They never tell the whole truth, ever.
Yep.
Which is the same about how he works the Palantir.
Mm-hmm.
and really how Palantir's work in general. Let's talk a little bit about, since we talked about Palantir, Farazan, I think he's being played as somebody who is really, really thinking about mortality. He's maybe at that age for a Numenorean who is, you know, he doesn't seem that old, but he wants to live forever, I think.
I would be interested to see whether there was perhaps more interaction that we didn't get or didn't see between Halbrand and Farazan. Because again, we—if you recall back, I believe it was episode 4,
where
we see Halbrand in the cell next to Farazan when Galadriel breaks out of the jail there, and you know, Halbrand is kind of whispering in his ear a little bit, and then the next we see Halbrand, he's just free walking on the walls.
Well, yes.
And I'm wondering if perhaps he also spoke to him more and kind of, you know, guided maybe some of this ambition.
He's going to have a long play going with Farazan, and I think there's going to be a war first. I think they're going to imitate... Now that they've got everything set up and ready to go, and we can get more into this in later things, I think there's going to be a similar pattern of war to the extended versions in the actual book lore.
Yeah.
A similar setup is happening.
Yeah.
So, anyway, Gandalf, Aloran, we just talked about how because they're not throwing curveballs in season one, I mean, that perhaps we're not going to get something different.
No blue wizard.
Like a blue wizard or even a Radagast. However, we could, and why? Because it's possible that wizards sort of think the same, use similar ideas, come up
similar language.
He is going off to Rune in the east. That's where the blue wizards went.
This is true.
The blue wizards are from the Second Age.
Yep.
Gandalf himself is not. Maybe he hung with the elves a little bit as a Aloran, but not with halflings.
Well, so... his time as a Aloran, which, by the way, is his Maiar name. So that's why I'm going to refer to him as such, because all the other names he ends up with were given to him. He doesn't choose any of them, you know, whether it's Gandalf or Mithrandir, etc. That being said, I completely forgot where I was going with that. Never mind.
That being said, other important things. We'll fill that in later.
Yep, yep, yep.
So, what about the dweller, the ascetic, the nomad? Why were they named those things? Was she dwelling any more than the ascetic? Was the ascetic more ascetic than the dweller?
I don't know. They all seem kind of nomadic to me.
But they live in Rune. I mean,
well, they're from Rune. We don't necessarily know.
Do they live?
Yeah, we don't even know what they are. You know,
what are they?
They did not seem human. Like even for a proposed human magic user, like what we know the Nazgul were. Like they seem like perhaps something else. I think it's a mystery, and that's why I mentioned earlier that. I feel the way they were pushed back to the shadows, that it leaves the door open for them returning, for those actresses and those characters coming back next season or down the road somewhere. I mean, we'll see if it happens, but I think they definitely at least left the door open for that possibility, the way they did it.
He was pretty serious about how he cast them, though.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, they were, once again, definitely pushed back to the shadows. But we know with the Nazgul, when they are pushed back to the shadows, when their physical forms are pushed back to the shadows, much like the Maiar, they have the ability to regain physical form again, because we see that in the books. So, again, it could be something that...
Maybe that their names have more to do with that than their physical visage.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the names have more to do with what they are spiritually. Maybe they are, you know, Maiar.
They could be. Well, you know, they could be Maiar. They could be, again...
or maybe someone who...
Corrupted magic users, like human magic users, whose spirits have gone to the Shadow Realm.
Maybe the objects that they hold are similar to the rings.
Yeah.
But they didn't seem to actually have physical form.
Yeah, I think it's an open-ended mystery. It's one of the few mysteries we still have that are open-ended in the show at the moment.
Well,
which I appreciate.
You can investigate. We can investigate a little bit more. Maybe there are more mysteries. You know, like, again, we know that Halbrand is Sauron. But we don't know how he got into that sea. We don't know about his true relationship with Adar.
Yeah.
We don't know about when he was killing orcs. I mean, that was his potential army down the road. I guess, you know, he's got no love of any of orcs.
No, I mean, you know, that being said about what we don't know, there's a few things which we didn't bring up earlier, which are some things we didn't get in this episode are no Arondir, no Bronwyn, no Theo, no dwarves, no Adar, and of course, you know, none of everyone's favorite character, Waldrig. You know, I mean, I miss the guy, I gotta be honest. But, you know, we didn't get any of those things, so those are also all open-ended for next season.
And no Balrog.
We weren't gonna get a Balrog.
I was getting my wings done and everything.
You know what, that's one I feel I called correctly, and that it's a setup for later on.
Come on, Jude, come over here and hang with us in Balrog Land. We like to have a good time.
But you smell funny.
Well, we do, but we drink and we make bad jokes.
You know, you got a point, maybe I'll come over. Damn it. Fire whip.
Like that. Oh, anyway. So, okay, so we're going to do another little bit of a season finale, deep dive-ish recap of the season.
We're going to look at our predictions from episode 0 and just how those played off, as well as perhaps make some predictions for next season, whenever that's coming out.
Yeah, now that we know a little bit more about how this show is working.
Yep.
You know?
And
but
we
can talk about the things that, not only the things that we got right, but the things that we wanted that we got out of the show, and maybe the things that we were not expecting.
Yeah.
Okay, so,
and, yeah. You know, I had one quick note, which was something I had said on the last deep dive, which we did, so I'll recap for anyone who didn't listen, and that was when we were talking about Celeborn, Galadriel's husband, and whether he was dead, alive, still missing, etc. I had said in that episode that I felt there was a 0% chance that he was dead, and after that episode, I was actually reminded in some of my research by the fact that, of course, elves sometimes have the ability to reincarnate, generally as themselves. And I feel that that is something that I was overlooking, that is a definite real possibility that perhaps he is dead.
Or and, they're sent back.
Right, that he is dead and may come back, essentially at that point, taking the place of Glorfindel, because, you know, we will get Glorfindel.
I wouldn't say that's an ability that we would ascribe to the elves themselves, though. It seems like a reward.
Yes, it's... So, you know, again, if he had died in battle... doing something like, I don't know, fighting a Balrog.
Or,
and like the, he may
so you know what he did, I heard. I know what he did.
But I'm saying he may take Glorfindel's place the same way, you know, it is their, you know, what, granddaughter who takes Glorfindel's place in the movie is, you know,
he
I think.
He had this move where he pretended to be a clam. And he did this thing with his arms and his legs. He flapped them. And then he got in close to the Balrog, and he cut off his wings.
And then the Balrog probably stepped on him.
It said, "I like clams, thank you. I'm a Balrog.
Yummy.
I'm a great big Balrog." All right,
but,
so
but no Glorfindel for you.
Yeah, there's going to be a little Glorfindel. No Glorfindel. He actually is friends with Balrogs now.
I don't think we're getting Glorfindel ever.
He trains them.
No Glorfindel for you.
He's coming back in the How to Train Your Balrog movie franchise.
No, I thought that was Durin.
Nope, it's just all Glorfindels.
I like
he's
the
only other character.
I like just, the Balrog being Durin's pet.
They, yeah.
And then, you know, one day he turns on him. It's what happens, like when you have a big snake, you
or
know?
A bear.
Exactly, you know, you got to watch out, you know, or a tiger.
Yeah, and then people are like, well, that's what you get.
Yeah.
Anyway, so
don't keep Glorfindels. Don't keep Balrogs as pets, kids.
No, or Glorfindels, because that's cruel. That would make them a slave, and they're
it's
elves.
Not nice.
They should be free.
It's not nice.
So, my name is Rob Law, and this has been the JRR You Talking to Me podcast, and I will bid you a fond adieu, and see you next time. Jude, would you like to take us out with some wisdom?
Yes, well, I've been Jude Fox, and if you'd like to contact us, you can email us at youtalkingtome@gmail.com or join our Facebook group at youtalkingtome about the fellowship. And I just want to remind everyone to like, subscribe, give us a 5-star rating wherever you find your podcast, and share with your friends to help grow the fellowship. Until next time, bye-bye.